This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. 40 years ago this month, the Shah of Iran was booted from his country and a new regime took over. This Western-friendly nation underwent a revolution. It became the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're going to hear a report today from trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about how this event set the world stage for the fulfillment of one of the most dramatic prophecies of the Bible. We'll also hear a report about a biblical miracle that has actually made headlines in recent months, the time during Joshua's day when the sun stood still. Researchers from the University of Cambridge claim to have identified this event down to the specific day it occurred. We'll hear from trumpet writer Chris Eames about their findings, and he'll explain why they're dead wrong. And I'll conclude today's show by talking about the importance of sacrifice, specifically the importance of sacrificing for the sake of family. But I want to start the show by following up on something I talked about last week, the trend in people calling for looser abortion laws, trying to reduce restrictions on late-term abortions. People are actually cheering the idea that abortion would be easier to get, more common. Well, I want to talk about the flip side of this issue, and that is the preciousness and sanctity of life. What is happening in the United States today over this issue vividly illustrates two very opposing perspectives regarding human life. One of them views it very casually, even hostily. The other recognizes it as something very special, uniquely worthy of preservation and protection. Where do you fall between those two views? The view of the inherent value and sanctity of human life comes from the Bible. This book reveals the God who created human beings. Its very first chapter describes God renewing the face of the earth, creating a beautiful environment that supports life. First, the atmospheric, the geological conditions, then introducing plant life in spectacular variety, then animal life in the skies and in the seas. Then he populated the land with creatures of every kind. It says cattle and creeping thing and beasts of the earth after his kind. Then finally, as the crowning physical creation, it says, Genesis 1, verses 26 to 27, God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. The first chapter of the Bible shows that human beings are unlike any other creation. We are made in God's image and likeness. And it says God gave us dominion over all the other creatures. Now, the rest of the Bible reveals why God made man, what his purpose for us is. And it's the most inspiring truth you can read. God took great pains to reveal his purpose to us, to give us great hope and inspiration and motivation to strive to live lives that are productive and moral and purposeful. King David wrote in Psalm 8, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, and moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you're mindful of him?" Out of all the vast material creation, why does God care so much about human beings? David wrote, "For you've made him a little lower than the angels and have crowned him with glory and honor. You made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air and the fish of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth." That's from Psalm 8. David was awestruck at God's marvelous creation and the fact that God placed human beings in such a position of honor at the head of it all. Now, the author of the Epistle to the Hebrews in the New Testament, he had studied David's psalm and he wrote about it. Hebrews 2:6 says, "But one in a certain place testified, 'What is man that you're mindful of him?'" Quoting Psalm 8. And then he quotes the verses about God putting the creatures under human dominion. Then he expands on that in an inspiring way. Herbert W. Armstrong explains this in his book, Mystery of the Ages. This is what he wrote. "But now the writer of the book of Hebrews is inspired to expand David's prophecy to add something radically different, something to happen in the world to come. This revealed knowledge of God's purpose for mankind, of man's incredible, awesome potential, staggers the imagination. Science knows nothing of it. No religion reveals it, so far as I know, and certainly higher education is in utter ignorance of it. Nevertheless, it is what God says he has prepared for them that love him." And he cites 1 Corinthians 2, verses 9 to 10. Mr. Armstrong shows how this passage in Hebrews 2 plainly reveals God's intent that man actually help him govern not just earth, but the universe. It talks about God crowning Jesus Christ with glory and honor, and how God intends to bring many sons unto glory the way he did Christ. The truth about God's purpose for human beings is so awesome and so wonderful. Mr. Armstrong wrote an entire book about it called The Incredible Human Potential, which shows how the Bible from beginning to end reveals this purpose in inspiring detail. God wants us to understand this. This truth gives our lives purpose and direction, and it gives us crucial perspective on just why it's so important to protect and preserve life. When we reject this truth the way modern secular society has, we can't see anything particularly special about human life. And then we descend into the type of thinking you see in the abortion culture in America today. Knowing that God has such a wonderful purpose for human beings, it makes perfect sense that he is so serious about protecting human life. He gave several laws for that purpose. Most powerfully, the sixth commandment, "Thou shalt not murder." Now, throughout history, societies that departed the furthest away from godly thinking have come to view murder not as a sin or a crime, but as a valuable tool for getting what they want. Governments like those under Mao Zedong, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Hirohito, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, they've had a very cheap view of human life, and they've killed millions upon millions of people as they've pursued their political aims. God considers human life so valuable that he commands in Exodus 21, verse 12, "He that smites a man so that he die shall be surely put to death." Now, this clearly shows there's a difference between killing and murder. God actually commands killing in certain rare cases. Many people think the death penalty is unjust and it's hypocritical, that it somehow degrades human life. But God says it actually shows the supremely high value of human life. It forcibly demonstrates just how precious was the life of that innocent victim. And it demands the severest of penalties for the one who took it. Now, the Bible reveals the coming of a future resurrection, a resurrection in which all sinners who've never known God, including murderers who are executed, will be given the opportunity to repent and live forever. You can read about that in Revelation 20, verses 11 and 12. God has no pleasure in the death of the wicked. But he demanded the death penalty not only to put a murderer out of his misery and to immediately reserve him for that resurrection, but also so that others would hear and fear, and it would prevent more innocent life being taken. You know, there's only one law that is repeated in all five of the books in the Pentateuch. That is God's command to kill a murderer. You can read instances in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy saying that. Now, in the law that God gave to ancient Israel, even God's punishment for manslaughter, accidentally killing a human being, was very severe. The killer had to completely uproot himself and move to a city of refuge. He had to stay there until the high priest died. And this definitely produced a respect for life, and it made individuals very careful of the life of their fellow men. They didn't want to accidentally kill somebody and have to undergo that punishment. That law that God gave to Israel even commands that if an animal kills a human being, it's to be put to death. There are a lot of ancient codes of law that address the matter of an animal injuring or killing a human being, but it's only in God's law where the animal was subject to the death penalty. And not only that, but the flesh of that animal couldn't be eaten. It was rendered unfit for human consumption. You can see in Babylonian law, the uppermost concern was to protect the property of the wealthy and the powerful. But in God's law, the sanctity of a human life was paramount. A life formed in the image and likeness of God. That's what was most important. God even protected the life of an unborn child in the womb. You can read in Exodus 21, verses 22 to 23. The New King James Version reads, "If men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows or no injury comes to the fetus, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him. He shall pay as the judges determine." So if a man hurt a woman who was with child and the child was fine, then he just had to pay damages for whatever inconvenience or hardship might have come on the parents. But it says this, "If any harm follows, then you shall give life for life. If his actions caused the unborn child to die, then he was sentenced to death." That is the plain teaching of God's law. In the eyes of the law, human life is sacred. The life of an unborn child is equal to that of an adult. And that's the penalty for accidentally killing a fetus. How do you think God views doctors who perform abortions or counseling services that advocate abortion or judges who decide that it's legal, quote unquote, or politicians and lobbyists and activists who encourage the passage of those kinds of laws? What does God think about that? The message about the supreme value of human life is consistent throughout the Bible. It's when we get away from that revelation from our Creator that we get ourselves into trouble. We begin to justify acts of brutality toward other human beings, even killing human beings. Abortion advocates always use noble-sounding language like freedom and choice and health care and equality and women's rights and women's health. But the closer you look into the actual practices of abortion, the more shocking and grotesque it is. Once people remove God from the picture, once they discard absolutes and they begin traveling down this road in their thinking, they end up justifying actions that are more and more horrific. And the Bible also reveals why that's the case. It exposes the true origin of such thinking, the God of this world, who is a malevolent spirit, who hates human beings. He wants to destroy us, but he rules this world. You can read that in 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. John 8:44 says, "He was a murderer from the beginning. There's no truth in him. He is a liar and the father of it. And he surcharges the air with hostility to the Creator. He is," Ephesians 2:2 says, "the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience." That murderous, lying spirit works in a world filled more and more with and governed by children of disobedience. You look at this issue and the contrast is stunningly clear between the view of that evil being and his influence and the view of the benevolent Creator. God is a God of life. He created life. He created human beings. He put safeguards in place to protect human beings from other human beings. And a society that respects his creation and respects his laws also respects life in all its forms. When human beings reject God's truth and revelation, we begin reasoning our way through questions of life and death. We subject ourselves to the evil influence of the enemy of human beings. And rationalization for all kinds of destructive behavior increases, even killing. One specific point regards when human life begins. According to the Bible, it is at conception. But the fact is, that's also the only scientifically viable view. That question can't be answered satisfactorily, definitively, any other way. We have an article on thetrumpet.com by Fred Dadalo called "Is Abortion Really Murder?" So then this article goes through several individuals, geneticists, professors at medical schools, and I'll just read what these individuals say in the quotes in this article. Each individual has a very neat beginning, the moment of its conception. Another one says, the beginning of a single human life is, from a biological point of view, a simple and straightforward matter. The beginning is conception. This other doctor says, I'm no more prepared to say that the early stages in the womb represent an incomplete human being than I would be to say the child prior to the dramatic effects of puberty is not a human being. This is human life at every stage, albeit incomplete until late adolescence. And another one says, by all criteria of modern molecular biology, life is present from the moment of conception. This article continues, the biologists and geneticists are the ones who ought to know. Of the dozens who testified, there was overwhelming agreement that conception marks the beginning of a human life. So the only reason why there would be any disagreement over that is because people want to justify killing an unwanted unborn child. And suddenly everything becomes very fuzzy in their minds. But if you're open to the biblical truth on this subject, I'd encourage you to visit thetrumpet.com and read this article, Is Abortion Really Murder? It also gives some very compelling spiritual proofs on this point. When you understand what God seeks to accomplish through human beings, it's very obvious why human life is so precious to Him and why abortion is such a terrible tragedy. God loves human beings and He wants the best for us. This is a beautiful truth that abortion advocates do not recognize. When we believe God's truth, when we believe His revelation, when we accept His guidance, and we follow His laws, then we're blessed for that. Our lives become infused with purpose and hope. Our thinking becomes cleaner and brighter and more positive. God tells us in Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19, I call heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that both you and your seed may live. God wants us to live. He wants our children to live. He gives us His truth and His law so that we and our children may live. And He tells us plainly, He pleads with us, don't choose death. Don't go your own way. Don't reason your way through this. Follow me. Obey me. Learn to think the way I think. Learn to view human life as I do. Learn my wonderful purpose for you and for your children. And choose life.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It has been 40 years this month since Iran's Islamic Revolution, the takeover of Iran by the forces of radical Islam. This event set the world stage for the fulfillment of one of the most dramatic prophecies of the Bible, as we will now hear in this report from Brent Noctegal.
In Daniel 11, verse 40, there's a critical end-time prophecy concerning two major powers. It foretells that at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. This is a prophecy for the time we're living in right now, and both these kings, the king of the south and the king of the north, are rising. For 20 years, we've said that this king of the south is fulfilled by radical Islam led by Iran. And for 20 years, we've been vindicated by news of Iran's offensive moves across the Middle East and the globe. In the past two decades, it's become clear that Iran's pushy foreign policy, guided by its desire to export Islamic rule across the Middle East and beyond, matches the policy of this king of the south. However, the seeds for the fulfillment of this verse were sown 20 years earlier. 40 years ago this month, Iran underwent a fundamental change known to us as the Iranian Revolution. Now, in 1979, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini returned to Iran from exile. He and other Islamist clerics declared Iran's monarchy to be extinct, and he and his fellow revolutionaries determined to rule the nation in a different way from before. This absolute rule of the clerics, or mullahs, would be known as Veliyat Fakih, and eventually it would mean placing supreme power of Iran in one individual. Now, it's true that many Iranians would not have supported the revolution had they known what the end result would be, and many of the speeches by Khomeini indicated that he was willing to rule in a more open way. While in exile, Khomeini gained popularity by using vague catchphrases such as, quote, "Islam is for equality and social justice," or "Islam will eliminate class differences," or "the duty of the clergy is to liberate the hungry from the clutches of the rich." Phrases like this gave many hope that Khomeini would rule in a different way than he had espoused earlier in his texts. Nevertheless, once he returned, it didn't take too long for Khomeini to impose the new constitution, which would place him as the supreme leader over both state and religion. However, in order to ensure his hold on power, he also established soon thereafter the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, a fundamentally military institution that is designed to protect and ensure the survival of the revolution itself, and would be run in parallel with the military, except it would be sworn to the protection and the direction of the Ayatollah himself. While the regular military and the IRGC are designed to work together during times of war, they mostly work separately during peacetime. They each have certain maritime zones to work in with each of their navies. They each have an aerospace division. The IRGC is in control of the ballistic missile program. While the regular military of Iran is estimated to have 350,000 troops and has a primary responsibility to defend Iran's national integrity, the IRGC has an estimated 125,000 soldiers and is charged with both the defense of Iran, but more importantly, the safeguarding of Iran's theocratic system. Now, the IRGC's proximity to Iran's clerical leader has given it immense power. It can be thought of as a praetorian guard, but much more than that. And the difference between a praetorian guard and also the IRGC is critical in understanding how strong and powerful the Ayatollah is, and therefore the Islamic regime is, in Iran. Praetorians were military guardians of Roman emperors, and their loyalty to the emperor afforded them power and influence. However, in Roman times, eventually the praetorians got so powerful that they could actually be corrupted to displace the emperors themselves. Put simply, the institution of the praetorian guard was as useful to the emperor as long as they were supremely loyal to the emperor, which was not often the case. However, in the case of the IRGC, those fighters are supremely loyal to the Ayatollah. This is how Afshan Ostavar described this relationship between the IRGC and the Ayatollah in his recent book Vanguard of the Imam. Quote, "As an institution, the IRGC expresses its devotion to the leader in distinctly religious terms. Khomeini and Khamenei have both been referred to with the honorific Imam, which in Persian is an allusion to the divine authority of the 12 Shiite Imams. The leaders have not been seen as equals to those immaculate beings, but their authority is derived from a similar divinity. In the absence of the hidden Imam, Iran's supreme leaders occupy the highest realms of authority achievable within Shiite society. Because of its proximity to the leader and occupation as the chief defender, the IRGC is cloaked in that authority. The organization's activities are inherently sanctioned by the leader and thus touched with the same essence of sacredness that he represents. As long as the leader does not publicly disagree with the organization, its actions are essentially unimpeachable within the context of Iran's system. It is unsurprising that the IRGC and its members have retained that faith in the leader. He is the source of their power and their guiding light. The spiritual implications of this relationship are unique and differentiate the IRGC from other contemporary state military organizations." As he says there, things are different in Iran. Whether it's China, Russia, or Turkey, each of these states have their own state military organization that reports directly to the leader to preserve the leader's rule. However, with Iran, there is the complete religious attachment as well. The only way that there could be a change in Iran is an overthrow of the whole system, another revolution, and that'll have to be done by the people, and it would mean civil war, going up against the IRGC. But the IRGC doesn't just protect the revolution at home. It's also designed to export the revolution elsewhere. See, for Iran, the Islamic Revolution didn't end in 1979. It's only just begun. According to IRGC Rear Admiral Ali Fadavi, guarding the Islamic Revolution does not mean guarding one country and one government. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps does not have any caveat attached to it, and these were the orders of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini names it as such because the Islamic Revolution is not limited to geography, and today you can see how people's passions follow the same context of the Islamic Revolution and how the Revolutionary Guards are present everywhere to protect it. The Iranian regime uses a variety of resources to accomplish this end. Among them is the IRGC's expeditionary arm, the Quds Force, Quds being the Arabic term for Jerusalem. The Quds Force has equipped, funded, trained, and mobilize Shia communities in other nations, inspiring religious fervor for subversive activities against their own governments. There's no accurate reporting of the number of members of the Quds Force, but it's likely around 20,000 individuals. However, that's far less than the number of forces actually under its command. As Ostevar wrote in his book Vanguard of the Imam, quote, "The primary function of the Quds is to develop and assist allied armed groups outside Iran. It helps train, equip, and fund a variety of organizations across the greater Middle East. This work has brought it into close partnership with groups such as Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, the National Defense Forces in Syria, and the Badr organization Shiite militias in Iraq, as well as the Houthis in Yemen." For Iran, all of these groups that the Quds Force works with are revolutionaries. They are continuing the Islamic Revolution that aims to spread Islam all over the world. In thinking about the Islamic Revolution, we can often make the mistake that it was a historical occurrence and no more than that. But truly, the Islamic Revolution in Iran wasn't just about regime change inside Iran, but a fundamental transformation in how Iran viewed the Islamic world and the rest of the globe. 40 years ago this week, Iran fundamentally transformed. And in such a way, the seeds were sown for the Daniel 11 verse 40 clash between two world powers. Two world powers that say, as in the days of old, that they have God on their side. If you would like to learn more about this clash between the King of the South and the King of the North, you can request our Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory's book, King of the South.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. So Stephen Flory talked about this on his Monday program and talked about it in the trumpet brief he sent out on Monday as well. Just going back and looking at the history, it's remarkable how wrong the politicians and the press of the time got this story. They thought the revolution was going to be a great development for the Middle East. And we haven't, just looking back at that, we clearly have not learned from that history.
Clearly not. This happens often when the Western media, it seems, and even, you know, us, I would say, in our minds, hope for the best, hope for a good result. When we fail to learn the lessons from history, I'd say one in this case was the fact that although publicly Khomeini was saying a lot of good things, how he was basically a social justice warrior and we're going to give money back to the people, we're going to end the Western corrupt regime of the Shah. A lot of people bought into that. A lot of Marxists bought into that. A lot of leftists bought into that. And so they supported his return. However, if people went ahead and read more of his earlier works from about 10 years preceding that, they would see that he had this great desire to turn Iran into a clerical state, a state that is ruled by a supreme leader. He believed in the mixing of religion and politics, where there were plenty of clerics on the ground in Iran that didn't. But that's where this was going to go if people read his works.
Right. That, I guess, is another trend that tends to play out, is that we just don't believe the actual words of a man in this kind of a position. We just want to assume the best despite what's actually coming out of his mouth or out of his pen. But looking at the situation today, there are a lot of people who look at the population within Iran and they see that there are a lot of people who are discontented with the current regime. But just given the political realities that you were talking about in your report, what is the potential for to be able to actually harness that discontent and to turn those people against the regime to where there could be a change in Iran?
It would be very difficult for this to come around. I think what we're talking about here is Iran will stay on its present course or we'll have regime change. And so there have been discussions that, you know, you can moderate it inside the government of Iran, but all of those still have the supreme leader at the front, still have his command over most of the economy of Iran. You still have his control over a lot of the forces, military forces of the nation as well. And so he is going to go about his policy of exporting the revolution to other places in the world, regardless of any changes domestically in terms of a more moderate, say, government right. in power. Remember, we have a moderate government in power now,
yep.
apparently. And that doesn't seem to change it. But you do feel for a lot of the Iranian people that are not happy with the direction of the nation. There's about 130,000 Iranians leave each year just because they want to pursue education. They want to get better jobs and a better life. And so they get visas for for nations because they're not happy there. And so given the realities on the ground, it's hard to foresee any type of change unless there is an absolute regime change. And for that to happen, you're going to have the people would have to rise up against the IRGC, the sworn defenders of the Islamic Revolution. They support the Ayatollah. They want this type of rule. And there's 120 plus thousand of them soldiers. And so they are already, there's been rumors on the streets already that they are moving to put down some of the anti-government protests that have been taking place over Iran over the past couple of months. This was their original job back in 1979 when they were established, 1980, cut off, take all the weapons from all those other organizations that could pose a threat to the Islamic regime. And now that you have disgruntled people in the population, that's what they're doing again. And so this is the big question. Will the people be strong enough to stand up against the IRGC and their support of the Ayatollah?
Yeah, and given just the prophecies that we're looking at, it seems like very, very unlikely, because the trajectory of the nation as it is presently set underneath the clerics in charge fulfills those prophecies precisely, and the timetable seems like to see some massive change within that country just doesn't seem to fit the prophetic timetable whatsoever. But we do appreciate you collecting all of that history. If you want more information, do please go to thetrumpet.com, and you can listen to the segment that Stephen Fleury did on this on his Monday Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and read his Trumpet Brief, Getting It Wrong on Iran for 40 Years. You can also look at the King of the South booklet by Gerald Fleury, a booklet that we've been promoting for decades now. He was pointing to Iran's role in end time prophecy back in the early 90s. And it is remarkable to see just how much of those prophecies have come to fruition. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Interesting stuff. Thanks very much, Brent.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Are the miracles in the Bible true? Many people want to believe they are, but sometimes efforts to prove those miracles can be misguided, as we will now hear in this report from Chris Eames.
Many of our listeners will be familiar with the biblical account of Joshua and the long day, the day that the, quote, sun stood still. Joshua and the Israelites were entering the Promised Land and were repelling a combined force of five Canaanite armies. Now, in order to completely vanquish the enemy, God caused the sun to, quote, stand still in the sky. And this allowed ample daylight for the Israelites to see and destroy their enemies. Now, there has been a wealth of archaeological and general scientific proof for the biblical accounts. And you can read more about that on thetrumpet.com and especially on the sister website, watchjerusalem.co.il. But an event like this, a miraculous event like this, how is this possible to verify? Well, researchers from the University of Cambridge have claimed to identify this very event. According to them, all is not as it seems. This event, they say, was actually an eclipse, and it occurred on October 30th, 1207 BC. These researchers base their claims on an apparent similarity between the root Hebrew word for stood still, what we translate as stood still, and a Babylonian term describing eclipses. So using this as the basis for their research, the scientists developed a, shall we say, eclipse code and allowed for a 450-year window of time for this event between about 1500 BC and 1050 BC to look for their eclipse. So from the computations, they found that only one possible eclipse occurred, and this on October the 30th, 1207 BC. There has already been much scholarly approval for an invasion of the Promised Land during the 1200s BC. Thus, the researchers took this as further corroboration that this eclipse was indeed the so-called miraculous event of Joshua's son standing still. So it all sounded good and made headlines when the research came out. Except it's completely wrong. Virtually everything about this research is contrary to the biblical account. Indeed, even the premise of the research seems to be to try and explain away a great godly miracle as being just a regular old eclipse. In an article that has come out in our most recent edition of the Trumpet magazine, I explain the problems with this research and show evidence that does exist for the biblical account of this battle. Suffice it to say that the very biblical passage used completely in itself disproves the notion that the original event was an eclipse. Joshua 10 verses 13 to 14 read, quote, "And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and," listen to this, "hasted not to go down about a whole day." Hasted not to go down about a whole day. This doesn't sound anything like an eclipse. And the passage concludes by saying, "And there was no day like that before it or after it." Now, this is unequivocal language and clearly doesn't refer to an eclipse. The Cambridge researchers' cherry-picking of one word as the basis for their research, of which the root of that word sounds like a Babylonian word used for eclipses, it's really an impossible stretch. But the scholarly attempt to, shall we say, strain at a gnat to explain away a great biblical miracle isn't unusual. It's been attempted many times before. One of the more hilarious examples is trying to claim that the manna that came down from heaven in the wilderness was actually just the shed skin of beetles, the shed exoskeletons of beetles. So back to our eclipse, though. You see, the Israelites could not have entered the Promised Land during the 1200s BC. The Bible affirms in several scriptures that the Exodus and the invasion of the Promised Land happened a full 200 years earlier, during the 1400s BC. Now, the reason several scholars dismiss the biblical record in favor of the 1200s date is because of a large amount of destruction material that has been discovered in excavations in Israel dating to the time of this later century, the 1200s BC. And then they point to a dearth of evidence of upheaval during the 1400s BC. But these same scholars ignore the fact that these remains of destruction from the 1200s BC actually match the biblical account of the Judges period, and that the great upheaval that took place during the 1400s is actually found in the archaeological record, during this time period. They conveniently ignore the vast amount of evidence of this massive upheaval in Canaan around 1400 BC, evidence that directly matches the account of the Israelite invasion. Now, one prime piece of physical evidence that Joshua's long day wasn't the eclipse of 1207 BC is an artifact called the Meneptah Stelae, a victory stone with a long inscription on the face of it. This artifact has the earliest confirmed reference to the nation of Israel, and it dates to about 1208 BC, so just before Joshua's supposed eclipse battle against the Canaanites. It affirms that Israel was an already established nation recognized here by Egypt, and according to the text on the stela, it had just been conquered, actually, according to the passage. So this then fits with the time period of the Judges, fits really nicely with the time period of the Judges, not as an Israel that was only barely entering the Promised Land, as the Cambridge researchers would have us believe. There is another artifact as well called the Berlin Pedestal that all but certainly references the nation of Israel as already being established in the land, and this one dates to perhaps a century earlier than the Meneptah Stelae. Again, on the whole, all confirming the biblical account without the need for this modern scholarly interpretation forced upon the biblical record.
Thank you for that, Chris. It is a really interesting story, and it's interesting how folks who look into this, they have enough interest in what is going on in the Bible, and they're trying to find some kind of evidence that, well, maybe this happened in some way or other, but they're so loose with the account itself in the Bible and trying to come up with, I guess, naturalistic explanations for these things. But I think you did a good job of just demonstrating how different what they're proposing is from what is plainly stated in the Bible. But if you looking at this, I guess, from a positive standpoint, you did a good job of, say, disproving the theory that they've put forward. What sort of evidence do you see that there could actually be, there may have been this long day in history?
Sure, there's a couple of researchers that have looked into this question, and some really interesting points that they've brought forth. One is Harry Rimmer, who in a book, I don't have the title here, but he summarizes a few parallel accounts from different cultures around the world. And obviously, if there was a long day in Canaan, there was a long day all the way around the world. And so he writes, in the ancient Chinese writings, there is a legend of a long day. The Incas of Peru and the Aztecs of Mexico have a like record. And there is a Babylonian and a Persian legend of a day that was miraculously extended. He looks at a couple of records of China, ancient records of a long day. He mentions, quote, Herodotus recounts the priests of Egypt showed him their temple records, and that and there he read a strange account of a day that was twice the natural length. So in that alone, there's a couple of just anecdotal evidences, really difficult to try and corroborate through archaeology, but found in different national histories all around the world that help point to this event having taken place.
So the idea being that if there was massive astronomical bodies in motion that were halted or things reversed, whatever the case might be, that would have been something that wouldn't have been experienced only in a patch of land in the Middle East. It would have been global.
Right. That's exactly right. So you would have a really long day on one side and a really long night on the other. But in terms of the entire context of this biblical story, now through archaeology, we can't tell the exact date as to when it happened. But we can tell a lot about the context of this battle, when it happened, what happened. And there is a lot of archaeological evidence for what happened here. And one of the significant pieces is a trove of documents known as the Amarna letters. Now, these date to the 14th century BC, right around the time that we see Israel entering into the Promised Land, dating to about that same time period. And it's interesting because most of these letters are from the land of Canaan to the Pharaoh of Egypt, and they're pleading with the Pharaoh, asking for help, any kind of help, against these people who are invading called the Habiru people.
Sounds kind of familiar.
Our listeners will obviously see the connection there with the Hebrew people, Habiru, as the Canaanites put it in these documents. And so they're describing this fierce nomadic group coming into the land of Canaan, describing it as overthrowing the entire land, to the point that there's one letter from the Jerusalemite king, the Canaanite king of Jerusalem, and he says, "I'm the only one left. All these other kings around me have been vanquished." And that's very similar to what the Bible says. Jerusalem was one of the last Canaanite cities to fall to the Hebrews. So we have this general account, archaeological account, showing a parallel record of the Hebrews coming into the land. But again, what about this specific battle described in Joshua 10? Well, these Amana letters do describe some specifics. So they show evidence of the cities belonging to the belligerent kings. They have evidence of Jerusalem, Lachish, Yarmut, and Hebron. They mention Ayalon, which is the valley over which the moon stood still. The Bible records the sun standing still over a part of the land and the moon standing still over Ayalon. So that is recorded, this valley in the Amana letters. The Bible mentions the Amorite kingdom in general. That's mentioned on the Amana letters. There's also a possible identification of the caves of Makkedah, which is where the fleeing kings, fleeing from Joshua, that's where they were trapped before being executed. And archaeological records even corroborate the account of when these kings were captured by Joshua. He had his men put their feet on their necks just before they were executed. And archaeological records show that this was actually a practice that was carried out in humiliation of the enemy just before they were killed. Their necks would be stamped on, basically, by their conquerors.
So in other words, just a lot of corroborative detail that demonstrate the accuracy of the biblical account,
right.
Maybe in some of those details that don't involve the miracle itself, but that all of the context of the way that it's written in the Bible can be corroborated through other evidence. Very interesting stuff. We appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Chris Eames about evidence supporting the biblical account of Joshua's long day. He's written an article about this. It was published in the most recent edition of the Trumpet magazine, the March 2019 edition, called "And the Sun Stood Still." You can read more about the evidence that he gave us in the report here and the interview that he gave us. Find it on thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much for your time, Chris.
It's been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
You've heard of the marshmallow experiment. A child is placed in a room with a treat on a table and told that he can eat it now or he can wait 15 minutes and get two treats. Some kids devour the marshmallow immediately. Others try to hold out but end up nibbling or gobbling. Only those willing to sacrifice immediate gratification receive the double reward. Sacrificing means surrendering something for the sake of something else. Success in life requires many sacrifices. We surrender marshmallows almost indefinitely for the sake of better health. The student surrenders an evening out with friends to study for an important test. The athlete surrenders comfort and ease for a shot at a championship. The musician surrenders thousands of hours for the sake of his art. Sometimes we'd rather avoid it, but the truth remains, anything truly worth having requires sacrifice. You must give up your time, money, comfort, pleasure, convenience, opportunity, independence, prerogative, and or other things. The greater the goal, the more you have to sacrifice. But for the right goal, the sacrifice is worth it. Sacrifice opens doors to greatness. Even transcendence. God is driven by the greatest, most magnificent goal possible, to enlarge the God family. And family is worth sacrifice. For God, pursuing this goal has required extraordinary planning, investment, resolve, zeal, toil, struggle, and countless sacrifices, some unimaginably severe. At Passover, God's people memorialize the greatest sacrifice of all, the Most High God, offering His only eternal and loving companion at genuine risk of losing Him for eternity. The Word surrendered His divinity, took on the form of a servant, gave His flesh over to satanic persecutors, and risked dying forever for the sake of the healing and salvation of sinners. God sacrificed His Son to offer others sonship. Christ sacrificed to the death to extend others life. His crucifixion opened the way for Him to say to human beings, "I ascend unto my Father and your Father." God, the Father of lights, begets His children of His own will, it says in James 1, verses 17 to 18. Gerald Flory wrote this in the Epistle of James booklet: "Building a family, physical or spiritual, requires no small commitment. This Greek expression means that God has a total, complete commitment, not only to start and nurture a family, but to complete it. God begat us, but that's only the beginning. The Father is committed to us until we are born, and then He provides for His family forever." The God family sets the unsurpassable example of sacrifice, sacrifice that opens the door to far greater things. On the human level, Abraham sacrificed his beloved son, and that guaranteed spiritual and material promises from God that have changed human history. And God asks us, like Abraham, to follow His example. Romans 12:1 says, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." We are to sacrifice not by dying, but by living, sacrificing our will every day for the sake of God's will. In fact, by emulating His model of sacrifice, we participate in the advancement of His ultimate goal, God shaping more selfless members of His family. By building so much of the human experience around family, God gives us specific opportunities to develop the sacrificial mindset needed for His goal. Success in family requires many sacrifices: giving up personal freedom and flexibility in order to marry, and still more, to have children; eschewing attractive alternatives to embrace the demanding roles of provider and homemaker; surrendering that evening of personal pursuits to help your daughter with her research paper; redirecting that vacation money to pay expenses for your son's soccer season; giving up space and energy and privacy to move your sickly, widowed mother into your own home. Right-thinking people can recognize the nobility in prioritizing and sacrificing for family. But this Satan-inspired society has come to venerate individual fulfillment and self-actualization instead. Far too many people have lost their natural affection, as is prophesied in 2 Timothy 3 and verse 3. Natural affection. That includes the sentiment that drives a man to pursue a woman and to devote himself to providing for and protecting and educating his family. Natural affection includes that tendency that motivates a woman to voluntarily subject herself to her husband and to welcome the labors required in having children and rearing children. When that natural affection is gone, individuals go their own way. Families shrivel or splinter, or they never form in the first place. Assess your roles within your physical family and within God's spiritual family. Ask yourself, how much have I picked up the world's thinking regarding family? Am I willing to make the sacrifices necessary to help this family flourish? How much do I need to change to truly think as God does? It takes spiritual depth to even understand this God family concept. and it takes commitment to follow through with it. Anytime you struggle with surrendering time, money, comfort, short-term pleasure, convenience, opportunity, independence, prerogative, or anything else, ask yourself, is this for the right goal? If it's sacrifice for the sake of family, the answer is yes. Your sacrifices are going towards something far greater than pleasures or comforts or recognition, greater than achievements or championships or art. You're sacrificing toward the ultimate goal. Meditate on God's example of sacrifice. He asks nothing of you that He has not already done infinitely more. And whatever sacrifice He asks of you, He promises not just a double reward, but manifold more in return. Jesus promised in Mark 10, "There is no man that has left house or brethren or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake and the gospel's, but he shall receive 100-fold now in this time, houses and brethren and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions, and in the world to come, eternal life." I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Nachtigall and Chris Eames. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Suzanne Goldsmith. Communities are not built of friends or of groups with similar styles and tastes or even people who like and understand each other. They're built of people who feel they are part of something that is bigger than themselves, a shared goal or enterprise, like righting a wrong, or building a road, or raising children, or living honorably, or worshiping God. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.